Heidi Sorrell, and I teach at Augustana College, where a number of presenters over the past 2 weeks have been here. My own area is twofold. I teach in ethics. There I wonder about applied issues in ethics. And I also teach in the area of philosophy of mind, and I do that in conjunction with a neuroscientist who oftentimes will teach courses on brain and behavior, and he and I team up and take a look at those two perspectives regarding who it is that we are. I also do some work in the real world, and that is I'm a clinical ethicist at a local hospital in the Quad Cities area, so that's a little bit of my background. For those of you who have been here before, you know that I tend to be pretty informal in my presentations, so please speak up as thoughts occur to you or as questions occur to you. And I'm going to do something, my days are limited here, I have exactly tonight and tomorrow left, so I'm going to do something a little bit different today, and I did something a little bit different yesterday. In the past, I have told a lot of stories, and I've also shared a lot of facts, and I will continue to share some heart-wrenching facts with you today, and I won't share any stories, because I think in some sense this material doesn't need to be motivated. A lot of times I use those stories to give really dynamic examples of the kinds of sometimes difficult points that I'm making. This is self-motivating, but it's also heart-wrenching. The other thing that I'm going to do a little bit differently, and again I did this yesterday, is I'm going to stop asking so many questions. One of the things I did all of last week was raised lots of questions and had a lot of food for thought, maybe for a lifetime. Today what I'm going to do is raise a few questions, but like yesterday, I'm going to start answering some of those questions. And so by the time you leave today, I think that you'll have a fairly clear response to the primary question that we're going to raise, which we'll get to in just a few minutes. I'm also going to talk about one argument. If you can't read this, don't worry too much about it. I will read it several times. We'll talk through the premises of the argument, and we're going to end up changing the second premise of this argument because that argument might be just a bit too demanding for us. So having said all of that, here's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about famine, how appropriate on Hunger Awareness Day. We're going to talk about affluence, and we're going to talk about reality. Those are the three things. And to get the discussion going, I think I'd like to start with a couple of givens, basic facts to just frame what it is that we're going to talk about today. Here's the first given. It seems to me pretty clear that rich nations, affluent nations, are not doing enough when it comes to famine relief. All right. So if you find any of these givens controversial, please speak up, because I take them to be non-controversial. So rich nations can do more to reduce famine. Here's my second claim, my second given. I think that individuals in those nations are not living up to their moral requirements. We could all give more. That's my second given. Third given, equally obvious with the first two, I hope, that is that natural disasters, such as tsunamis, earthquakes, hurricanes, and man-made disasters, such as the disaster in the Gulf, will continue to occur. They're not going to stop. So with those three uncontroversial, I think, assumptions, I want to ask and address this question today. And that question is, what are the moral implications of a situation such as ours? Where rich nations could give more, we could give more to prevent very bad things from happening, like suffering and death from famine. And what causes suffering and death in many, many cases is something that is going to continue. Those are those natural and man-made disasters. So that's our question. What should we do in light of those three facts? All right, if those three facts aren't enough, then I thought I'd share some more facts. All right, and these are the heart-wrenching facts. These are actually dated from April 26th of this year, so they're a little bit old. And they come from a number of sites, the best of which is called StopTheHunger.com. StopTheHunger.com. That particular website gives you real-time statistics about these kinds of issues. And so you're going to get those real-time statistics from April 26, 2010. quite a few here, but I think we can work with these as we go through the next hour or so. So rough, and I will actually, I will average up, so they're not the precise numbers, they take it down to the very last digit. So roughly 8 billion current people live on this earth, 8 billion. We're not quite there, there's some question about how far we are, but we're close enough. There are 1 billion of those 8 billion that are undernourished right now, 1 billion. There are also 1 billion overweight people in the world right now. All right? There are 338 million obese people in the world right now. Those obese people are excluded from the 1 billion people who are overweight. All right? So clearly, there are people who have more to eat, and they far outnumber those that have less to eat. All right. There are 20,000 people who died of hunger today. 20,000 people, 637 if you want to know exact. The people who have died this year, as of April 26, are 3,200,000 people, just in the first 4 months of this year. In terms of the economics of this particular situation, $182 million, U.S. dollars, were spent due to obesity-related diseases in the United States today, in a single day. $182 million. $85 million was the amount of money spent on food purchased here in the United States today and then tossed. All those extras when you only eat half your meal. All right? $85 million worth. The amount of money spent, U.S. dollars spent, on global food aid today was $3,900,000. The amount that it would take to feed the hungry in a single day is $25,700,000. $79 million was spent today on weight loss programs in the United States alone. $694,000 was the amount of money that U.S. agribusiness corporations gained in profit from food aid programs today. We'll come back to that number. $694,000 today in profit from food bank operations by major agribusiness corporations. Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland being two of the four. $33 million was spent on pet food in Europe and the United States today. All right, so $33 million spent on pet food in Europe and the United States, when it takes $25 million to feed all the hungry in the world one full day. All righty, a little bit more. 95,000 tons of food were wasted in the United States today. All right, along with that $85 million that we spent on the food that we didn't eat. 1,900 tons of global food aid were provided today. All right, a few more. 80%, you probably know this, 80% of harvested corn, grains, and soybeans was fed to animals today. 78% of malnourished children who live in countries with food surpluses. So there are 78% of malnourished children live in countries with food surpluses. Where does that food surplus go? Europe and the United States. All right. And then 90% is the percentage of hungriest nations on the earth that are net exporters of food to rich nations. All right, coupled with that preceding fact. Just a few more. One child every 5 seconds dies from hunger. One child every 5 seconds. So we're in here how many seconds? Well, 60 minutes, but how many seconds is that? It's a lot of kids. Poor nutrition and calorie deficiencies cause nearly 1 in 3 people to die prematurely or have disabilities. These facts come from the World Health Organization. That would be 1 in 3 people out of that 8 billion people. In 2009, about 9.7 million children died before they reached their 5th birthday. A lot of those children died not from hunger, but from hunger-related illness. One other quick fact, there's a lot that I could say about this, but I won't follow through with all of those facts. HIV AIDS has not helped this situation. In Africa, we know that HIV AIDS is incredibly present within Africa, and it has been most costly to the young adults who harvest food for their communities. All right, now think about the implications of that. If the food isn't being harvested, if it's not being planted, there's even more hunger as a result. So actually, the World Health Organization now has a new category for households in Africa, and that category, given the gravity of the HIV/AIDS situation, is that of child-headed households. Child-headed households. All right, to put a slightly different spin on some of these facts that I'm sharing, and this is my last page of facts, and in some sense, it's the most startling page of facts. I cringe every time I read these. For the price of one missile, a school full of hungry children, approximating about 300 children, could eat lunch every day for 5 years. 5 years. Throughout the 1990s, more than 100 million children died from illness and starvation. Those 100 million deaths of those children could have been prevented for the price of 10 stealth bombers, or what the entire world spends on its military in 2 days. All right, so hope for a miracle, right? If you think about what I said yesterday. Would it be at all possible for the worldwide military systems to shut down for 2 days, all right, and save 100 million kids? All right, so decisions. Nearly one in four people live on less than a dollar a day, while the world's 358 billionaires, at last counting, have assets exceeding the combined annual incomes of countries with 45% of the world's population. In 1994, the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. estimated that one out of every six elderly people in the U.S. has an inadequate diet. That's from 1994. The numbers have gone up in 2004. They've almost doubled. That's our people, right? People here in the United States. In the United States, hunger and race are related. In 1991, 46% of African American children were chronically hungry, and 40% of Latino children were chronically hungry, compared to 16% of white children. Those numbers have also doubled. So in some cases, they've tripled. Right? Again, that's our country. That's where we live. One out of every eight children under the age of 12 in the United States goes to bed hungry every night, as of 2009. One out of eight children. To satisfy the world's sanitation and food requirements would cost the United States $13 billion. What the people of the United States and the European Union spend on perfume each year. All right, and finally, the last one. The assets of the world's three richest men, are more than the combined GNP of all the least developed nations on the planet. All right, so those are some of the facts that I want to consider as we move through our questions. Okay, given those three givens we started with, given all of those facts, right, if we hold that as a given, right, and we look at our question, what does that mean for us? What does that mean we ought to do? Right? Well, we ought to give more. But let's be a little bit more systematic in thinking about just how harsh that demand is. All right? And then what we'll do is we'll look at the opposite side. As many of you know who have been in my classes before, I always like to see what my opponents say. Because if I can argue against my opponents because I know their arguments, that's a good thing. Okay? That's why I bother, right? If you go back to the talk we had yesterday. So here's an argument. This is an argument, it's a version of an argument that was given by a person named Peter Singer. He used to teach, he had a tenured position at Princeton University. He was from Australia, he is an Australian national, but he got a tenured position at Princeton University, not a bad place to be. And he held that position for 10 years and then decided that it was immoral to live in the United States and went back to Australia, where he is the first to concede that Australia also has significant problems, but not quite as many, because they're not making those stealth bombers, right? They're not spending that money on the war in the way that we are. Right. He's also, by the way, the one who, when his, I may have told some of you this, that when his son turned 10, for his 10th birthday, his son wanted a bicycle, wanted a brand new spick and span bicycle, like all the other kids on the block in Princeton where his son was living. And his dad, Peter Singer, said, no, I'm not going to get you a new bicycle, but I'll get you a bicycle. So he took his son to the local Salvation Army store, which in Princeton is a pretty nice Salvation Army store, and let him pick out the bike of his choice. All right, so Peter Singer lives the kind of life that he preaches. All right, he's a vegetarian. He has no plastic or leather in his clothing or in his briefcase, and very little of it in his house. All right, so he's consistently advocating by the way he lives the life that he is telling us about here in this argument. So here is the first premise. Again, this could be taken as a given. Suffering and death for lack of basics is bad. All right, does anybody disagree with that? I'm not asking you to disagree, but if you'd like to disagree, go ahead. So suffering and death from lack of basics is bad. What does lack of basics mean? For him, in this argument, it means lack of food, lack of shelter, and lack of basic medical care. For example, vaccinations. All right? Second premise. This is the one that we will come back to. We're going to revise because it's too harsh. This is Singer's premise. Singer lives by this premise, but he doesn't want us to live by this premise because it's too demanding of us. All right? So here's what it says. If it is in our power to prevent something bad from happening, without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, then we ought to do so. Now, he doesn't think that's too morally demanding, but he's being realistic. And the key claim here is right there, without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral value. What does that mean? What that means for him is that this premise does not require us to go out and do good. It does not involve what I called last week the principle of beneficence, where we have positive duties to help others, as, for example, physicians have or nurses have, right? They take on extra duties such that in certain situations they have obligations that we don't have. Okay, it doesn't require anything like that. All right, that would be too much. All that without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance requires of us, all that it requires of us is that we do no harm. Right? That we do no harm. Now, 2 points to note on that. 1 point to note on that is that this does not require, then, that we sacrifice so that we have diminishing returns, right? That we sacrifice to the point of marginal utility, if you want to think of this in terms of economics. It doesn't require, if we're living a lifestyle there, that in order to reach parity with those who are very, very poor, we have to go below their level or equal out. It doesn't require that, because that would be more than comparable moral value. And that's the first point to note. Second point to note is I have a physician friend who I talk about these issues with, and he came up with a great analogy. He's an emergency room physician, and he said, well, here's my analogy. What this requires of us is how I think about my job in the emergency room. When I'm dealing with a patient in the emergency room, my aim is not to lose. My aim is not to win. All right? So his aim is not to lose. It's not about winning for him. Winning would require going above and beyond. He just doesn't want to lose his patient. All right? So that's what's going on here. Do no harm. It does not require that we all become missionaries or that we all give up our goods to the point, again, of diminishing returns. But Singer says that's too much to demand. Okay, clearly the conclusion follows. We ought to prevent suffering and death from lack of basics. It clearly follows from those two premises. But he says that's too much for us Americans. So what he says is let's change this to say, without thereby sacrificing anything of moral importance. Without thereby sacrificing anything of moral importance. That's more our speed, he says. He's talking to Western Europe, too. He's very hard on them. So he says, all right, their nice new business suit, because after all, we are in an affluent society, so we can buy these nice new business suits when we need them for an interview, all right? And the person's walking along, and there's a river that he walks by in order to get to the building where he has the interview. And in that river, there is a child that's drowning, all right? So he thinks to himself, well, gee, I'm going to be late to the interview, and I'm going to mess up my business suit, not to mention my wingtip shoes, but I can save that child's life. In terms of morally important, it's not a question, right? I mean, obviously the wingtip shoes and the business suit can easily be replaced, and presumably you would only want to work with an employer who would forgive you for being late at an interview for that reason. But here we save the life of a child, all right? So that satisfies this. But I got a better example. I got to write this to Peter Singer at some point. Here's my example. Suppose that this happens to all of us. Maybe it happened on your trip here. It happened on our trip here. We were in O'Hare in Chicago at the airport, and my family and I were walking along one of the corridors there, and my daughter sees a penny, and she picks up that penny, but she picks up that penny for a good reason, all right? How many people in O'Hare walked past that penny? I mean, it's just a penny. Right? Have you ever walked past a penny? You see a penny, maybe even you see a dime, and you just keep on going. All right? And suppose that that penny, or that nickel, let's stick with the penny, it'll work. Suppose that that penny is lying in a dirty ditch. You're not going to pick it up then, right?
I'll pick them all up.
I pick them all up too. But most Americans don't. All right? And that's the point. Because that means that we don't need our pennies. Because if we needed them, we'd pick them up. All right? So let's think about this a little bit further. Suppose that we're not out there looking for pennies. I think there are more useful things that we could do. But when we see a penny, we pick it up, which is why my daughter picks it up. All right? But let's suppose that instead of looking for pennies, we take one penny a day and stick it in a coffee can. All right? That doesn't involve any significant moral sacrifice, right? That doesn't involve any moral sacrifice whatsoever. So by the end of the year, we have 365 cents. All right? Let's round it up to $4. Maybe on some days we're feeling more generous, all right? So we have four whole dollars at the end of the year. So suppose that there are 600 people in Holden, or 500, I guess, is capacity. 500 people here in Holden Village. And they all have their $4 as a result of feeling rather generous that year. All right? That's a lot of money. 600 times $4. That's a lot of money. Suppose that everybody who comes to Holden over the year were to do that. That's even a whole lot more money. Suppose that every American were to do that. Then all of a sudden, we've made a statement. So what Singer wants to know of us, right here, right now, if he were here, he'd press us hard and harshly. He'd say, why don't you do it? That's his argument. So why don't we do that? And again, apologies to those of you up there, because I don't tend to look up, but I'm getting better. So, what's our response?
Apathy.
First of all, he's living a little bit of an disingenuous life. Moving to Australia, they don't need to have a B-1 bomber or whatever, mm-hmm. because another country makes them.
Yeah?
He's snuggling up against big, Uncle Sam.
Not necessarily. Here's the response that Peter Thompson gave last week. His claim is, well, we here in the United States are all paying for those stealth bombers through our taxes. It's very, very hard, but possible, to get an exemption to indicate that you only want your taxes to go to, say, libraries or fire departments. Okay, we can all do that. Anybody in this room do that? I'm an ethicist and I don't do that because it's a hassle. All right? So when he was living in the United States, he went to the trouble to get the tax form, and it's a lot of trouble because I've tried. I have one friend in Vermont who has done this as well. Every year you got to go through the moves. It takes a long time. It's a big hassle. But then, right, you are not living disingenuously. And Singer did that when he was here. So he didn't buy any bombs when he was here.
But he enjoyed the benefit of them, the protection of them.
Yeah, at the cost of 100 million children's lives? I mean, those are choices that we make. Those are choices. Those are questions that Peter Thompson pushed us so hard on last week. And I know you were there, so you can help me out here, right? But those are choices that we have to make. And as Christians, if we are Christians, how do we justify those choices? Doesn't mean that they can't be justified. It just makes me really, really uncomfortable. So help us out.
What is the intake of Disney World, including entrance to the park, meals at the park, housing while there for one day?
It's a demonstration of our affluence. It's a demonstration of our affluence. And as we will see as we go on, because Singer has page two, all right, it's also a demonstration of our poverty.
Now, what is the financial figure for that question?
Pardon?
What is the financial figure for that question?
For the Disney World question? I don't know. I've never been to Disney World for that very reason.
It's a poverty of soul, not a poverty of the pocketbook.
Right. Right. The statistic that I went over last week, is this one. In the United States, I've got to get this right. Since 1990, our consumption of goods, of lots of junk actually, but our consumption of goods, big TVs, iPods, MP3 players, computers, clothing, all of that kind of stuff, new cars, has gone up 45%. All right? 45%. Though when asked about our quality of life, it's gone down 51%. So we consume more, but our quality of life has gone down. And there are all sorts of details that we could look at that support that basic overall claim. So back to the question. Given who we are, right, given that simpler argument, that less demanding argument, what are we doing?
I hate to say this, but probably I don't really care.
Which was your claim. You said apathy. I heard you say apathy. But how come? Well, why have we lost care? And actually, yesterday, if you read the little blurb, and I made very quick reference to it, but we ran out of time, there is this difference between care and concern. And in our society, if I would have had more time, I would have said, we have a whole heck of a lot of concern, and we've lost care. Now, think about two words, child care, health care. Why don't we call that health concern and child concern, right? See the subtle differences in language? We talked a little bit about language yesterday. We've lost a lot of our capacity to care. And you're absolutely right, and you're absolutely right. We don't care. But Singer has something to say to you. I'll get to your comment in just a second. When he turns to page two, and this is not all Singer, but I'll tell you when it is Singer. Singer says two things right away. One thing that he says on page two is that distance in our global village, sometimes he calls it a spaceship Earth, right, distance in our global village does not matter morally. Now, of course, it matters psychologically. That's why it's convenient for us not to care really about, for example, what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico, because it is exactly on the opposite of this great country of ours. And how much less we can afford to care about things that are happening in Ethiopia, or Southeast Asia, or Africa, all right? Especially when we see the wonderful facilities for the World Soccer Cup, right, in Africa. I mean, they looked like they were doing just fine, all right? So we don't have to care. Singer says, you're right, psychologically, it does make a difference. Distance does make a difference. Morally, not a bit of difference. All right, go ahead.
What you just said is about size and the distances as well. I was going to bring up that by studying off the astronomical size of the problem. We're sitting as Americans secluded in the mountains, you know, like.
I thought of that too.
You know, and I just wanted to bring that up, and I think that it's sort of that consumption factor is a systematic thing that has to do with our concept of capitalism and what Bill McKibben calls hyper-individualism.
Right.
And instead of counter that, you have to bring it back down to community and to what you can do around you, as opposed to trying to solve global problems.
Right.
And so it gets back to relationships and the dude living down the street under the bridge, or the guy that can't uphold his mortgage, you know, two doors down.
But we also don't care, in their sense of that term, about the fact that 1 in 12 elderly U.S. citizens are hungry, or that actually even higher numbers of U.S. kids go to bed hungry, right? So we don't even care about our neighbors.
I would take it a step further than that, too.
Yeah?
I mean, I'm sure other educators here can say the same thing. I'm being a school bus driver. I interact with kids on a daily basis throughout the year who are starving for a hello.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let alone a meal.
Right.
Attention from their parents.
Right.
A chance to learn about what real love is.
We're going to get to that, too. We're going to look at the costs of consumption, all right? That's part of what's going to be down here. And how that impacts the fact that 51% of us over the past 10 years have felt that our quality of life has gone down. 51% of us. And for those of you who are doctors and lawyers, you lead that category. You are the least happy people in the United States. Right, so I'll just throw out that thought. Okay. Dentists are up there too. Okay, second claim from Singer is this one. Numbers, and I'll have to clarify what that means. Numbers don't matter morally either. And by numbers here, his claim is, oh, if you have that thought, well, you know, I know that my neighbor, or I know that there are a bunch of other people who give to charity, so I don't have to give to charity this year or today. I don't have to drop my penny in my little coffee can because I know everybody else is doing it. That doesn't cut it either, right? Because you can give a penny. Well, heck, we could probably give a $5 bill every day. Now multiply that by 600 people, right? So he says, numbers of benefactors don't matter, neither does distance. All right, now we get into some more interesting facts. Not that those are not interesting. Four other things that we need to say that follows from that argument of his, and then if we have time, we'll take a look at the opposing side. There's this fancy word. I know I've given you some really cool Scrabble words, and here it is another one. Supererogatory acts. All right. Sometimes they're just called supererogations, but supererogatory acts. One of the only words in the English language that I know has an ER and an ER bunched together like that. A supererogatory act is the fancy name for an act of charity. All right, so an act of charity is not a neutral action. A neutral action is like, you know, taking the cap off this marker or, you know, hitting the stone there. Those are purely neutral actions. Those are morally uninteresting. All right? Supererogatory acts are also not obligations, right? We have certain obligations to our children, right? Or to our parents or to each other, right? Those moral obligations oftentimes have a legal kind of complement. If you don't follow through on caring for your children, then bad things will happen, as they should, all right? Supererogations are in between those neutral acts and those obligations. So if you don't give to charity, you're not going to be put in prison. If you don't put your penny in the can, right, you're not going to be fined, all right? But it is something that we ought to do. We're just not obligated to do it. On Singer's argument, he says, with respect to his argument, these things become obligations because they don't cost us anything, right? They require no moral sacrifice whatsoever. change in our thinking, which brings us to page 3. And this is where, whoops, I had numbering problems the other day. This is where it gets close and personal. This is where you are exactly right. It gets to our consumptive habits. All right. So when I said earlier, you know, Peter Singer, he does not use petroleum products, nor does he use leather, because it takes a lot of food to feed those cows, and he wants that food, that grain, to go elsewhere, right? So his, when Peter Singer talks about these kinds of consumptive things, he's consistent. And he thinks about everything that he buys. So if you look at the clothes that you have on today, I know this has plastic in it. This does not have plastic. My shoes has leather. This has petroleum written all over it, as does this, as does the soap that you use, and the lip balm, though not the lip balm that you can buy at Golden Village, because it is unpetroleum. All right? Your dish liquid that you use at home, you know, the Dawn and the Dove and all of that, that has petroleum products in it, but not the dish liquid we use here at home, if you, at least the one that we have in our house. If you look at the back label, it says if you use our dish liquid as opposed to the regular stuff, then, you know, 400 houses can be, I don't know, there's a lot of, I should have looked at it more carefully. This was a couple of days ago. But there are lots of benefits to using non-petroleum-based dish products, dish soap, dish liquid, right? So, and besides, putting that on your faces when you wash your face or when you wash your hair, do you know how much petroleum is in your hair, right? If you get rid of all of that stuff, it's good for us. Is that petroleum-free? Caught you.
She was checking it.
I was checking it.
Okay. All right, that's a first step. But if you think about all the petroleum products that we have in our lives, they're cheap, but they're costly given long-term kinds of health, interacting health concerns that arise, all right? And they're costly environmentally. And they fuel our consumerism because of their cheapness, all right? Because they're inexpensive. So all of that goes back to your comment, plus more. So let me say what number 4 is. And this is here, these last 3 points that I'm going to make, Singer talks about, but not the way that I talk about them. There are other people who talk about this kind of stuff. It doesn't come from Singer. Quick question? Did I see a quick hand? No.
I was just wondering how long it took to Mr. Singer to sail.
Right. Yeah. But you know what? Is that a fair criticism?
Yes. Sure. Yes.
It's a form of criticism.
Good. How was it fair for us to come to Holden then?
I was just about to say that was my bus.
He still lives off of many things that the West takes for granted.
Yeah.
Pretty good from Bobby.
He's pretty much self-sufficient in terms of his food.
If he moves, I don't know him, of course, but so he's just an allegory or whatever. But
he's like Wendell Berry. If you know Wendell Berry, he's like Wendell Berry, but he's living in the academic world because he says academics are some of the worst offenders.
If he, what we had, who was the man from South Africa?
Alan Story.
Alan Story
lives in poverty by choice. He's an amazing light.
Yeah.
And that would be going, I think, this in the right direction. But still, living in a Western society you get a lot of benefits.
You do get a lot of benefits, but you can choose to reject those benefits. Singer has 3 pairs of clothes. He has a white shirt and he wears blue jeans. They're all cotton. And his story about his 3 pairs of clothes and his canvas sneakers, all right, is that he has a pair of clothes, a white shirt, and his blue jeans that have to be washed. They're dirty. He has another pair that's on, and he has a 3rd pair hanging in the closet for the next day or in case of emergency. How many of us have 3 pairs of jeans and 3 white shirts? He also has a wool sweater that comes from his wife who spun the wool. How many of us can attack Singer for his Western habits, if that's the life he lives? I'm not going to attack him because he is way ahead of me.
One other thing too.
But what does he do with academia? Doesn't he take part in all of its benefits? The technology and the library and all the
He teaches. He gets the word out. He's changing the lives of many students.
Does he publish?
He does publish.
And what kind of ink does he use and all that?
But why are we beating up on Peter's
Listening to this, I'm much more concerned with my lifestyle than criticizing him.
We could all do everybody a great service by quit pointing the finger at each other and point the fingers at ourselves. Nothing personal against anyone, but look at yourself first before you look at anyone else.
Okay.
Judge not, lest you be judged yourself.
Are you feeling uncomfortable yet? You should be.
No.
Really uncomfortable. Okay. Oh, wait. You first, and then we'll go with you.
I think to get kind of back to the original question or sorting, maybe rewording it to are you doing what you can, and can you do more?
And the answer is? Yes.
Try.
Right? Yes. The answer is you can at least try.
Try.
That's right. You can check out your lip balm. Actually, my lip balm is Burt's Bees, which I thought was pretty good. You know, with beeswax and all of that. He does have, Burt's Bees does have some unpetroleum-based lip balm, but the one I'm using does not. So I have to pick up some of the unpetroleum at Holden. And you know what? If you run out, if they run out of unpetroleum before I get there, that's good. Right? That's good because that means you have gotten there before I have. Okay, and were you going to say something too?
I was going to say what exploded here is that, you know, why are we looking at somebody else? We need to look at ourselves. So,
Okay. One more comment and then we'll get to three or four.
Isn't the heart of Singer's argument not even going to the supererogatory acts of giving a dollar, but just evaluating our lifestyles and saying, who cares about giving away?
Right.
Let's do no harm.
Right. Giving a dollar would be supererogatory. Giving a penny is not. Right, and you're absolutely right. Okay, so what does this come to? It means that we need to examine the value, and I'll put this word up here too, the value and necessity of a consumerist lifestyle. And I think there is a movie being shown tonight called Affluenza. How appropriate is that? In addition to lunch today, right, which was World Hunger Awareness. So is that a coincidence? I'll let you think about that.
Nope.
For those
it's
of you
a
who
miracle.
Are here,
yeah.
It is a miracle.
That's good planning.
Okay. Actually, I don't think it was planned. It was
no,
a
we're
well, big guy's got to take care
okay.
of it.
Okay. All right. Okay, so the value and the necessity of a consumerist lifestyle. Let me just give you a couple of facts here, too. These are as of, when are these? These are as of, some of these are as of 2009. There is one that is not, and that's this one. It was in 1987 that the number of shopping malls in the United States exceeded the number of schools. Elementary, middle, and high school combined. Okay, so the total number of elementary, middle, and high schools is smaller as of 1987 than the number of shopping malls.
Define the shopping mall.
I don't know, like North Park and South Park. These enclosed big things. These enclosed, like Mall of America and on smaller
Mall of
scale.
America is three malls together.
Yeah, well, it's that kind of mall. It's not the strip mall.
Okay.
Right? 1987, that's a long time ago. We haven't stopped building them until last year. Here's another one. This one is haunting, and I think John DeGraff is going to talk about environmental issues. You did today, and you're doing it tomorrow? Okay, all right, so this is an astounding one. I do a little bit of environmental ethics as well at Augustana because I teach a social ethics class, and I think environmental ethics is a social ethics issue. But here's one that gets at the price of progress and consumerism and petroleum. The amount of motor oil sent to landfills or poured down our drains is 180 million gallons per year. Is that scary?
What's the goal?
Right? So that little, you know, that little cup that you might pour down or that you might put in landfill or that you might dump out on the grass, right? That comes to the tune of 180 million gallons per year. That 16 times the Exxon Valdez spill. All right? Here's another little cost of progress. In terms of consumerism and all those shopping malls that we're building, 9 square miles of land are lost every day to development. 9 square miles of land every day. Put that together, the number of acres that were blacktopped in, this was 2009, was 1.3 million acres. All right, and that's pretty consistent for the past 10 years. That would be the size of the state of Delaware. Okay, just pave it, right? Just pave it. Every year, pave the size of Delaware. All right, now that, again, is far away from us here right now in the Pacific Northwest, because that's over on the East Coast. We can let them do what they want, but that's the wrong attitude, right? That's the wrong attitude. Okay, here is another fact. There's the first one. This one builds on that one. Consumerist societies, societies, T-I-E-S, distort our goals, oops, G-O-A-L-S, and values, and purpose, and all of those kinds of things. Okay, they distort our values, all right? So we want that newest pair of Keens that come out. Keen, of course, is very smart because they actually, have new styles that come out each year, right? So you might get tired of your first style that you had last year, and they've got some really cool styles this year. And they're also heavy duty into petroleum. I have a pair of Keens, Peter Singer does not, but I do, all right, because I don't have them on right now with my Birkenstocks on. And that speaks to the problem, right? Right? So they distort our values, our goals, our purposes. We want to consume. You know, how many times do we have to upgrade our computers? Well, we have to because we're forced to in some sense, because things become incompatible with our computers if we don't have the most recent or a relatively recent computer. That's a problem. That's a problem with us wanting those products and with our society forcing those products upon us. All right, and you can go through many, many more examples of that, and I can give you some more examples of distorted goals and purposes. Let's see, since 2000, the increase in average daily TV viewing is 39%. All right, that's because we have those cool flat screen TVs now, right, in our home theaters. All right, that drives up our watching, not to mention cable and all of that stuff, right, that drives up our watching of TV by 39%. Of course, that also means that Americans spend 40% less time with their children than they did in the year 2000. 40% less time. Now, you have to be careful how you read that. That 40% less time means pure play time. All right? So, of course, we spend time with our kids driving in the cars, all right? Or with our kids at school functions, all right? Or with our kids at sports. But notice, that's not with our kids, really. I mean, that's a kind of being with our kids. But pure playtime with our kids, 40% less in the last 10 years. That's why we consume more, but our quality of life goes down. Yes?
Well, and I am impressed with the statistics and the way they make me think. But I do, being a mathematician in the past, wonder where, how do they develop these statistics? How do they know that this is based on anything other than wanting to make a dramatic impact?
Right. One of my favorite books is How to Lie with Statistics. You might know that book. It's a classic. I teach logic and fallacies, so I know about that. But these are some of the best controlled studies that psychologists can do. I mean, they're random sampled. They're widely sampled. They rule out biases. So this is as good as it gets. And part of what this might suggest to us is, for example, that we, again, a number of you said this, look within our lives and see what's happening there. At my kids' school, and I think this is true of many schools, you know, summer vacation comes along, and as a parent, you get the question, well, which camps are your kids going to this summer? And then, you know, some of the really, I don't know, there are many, many parents who say, well, let's see, the first week they have soccer camp, the second week they have Boy Scout camp, the third week they have church camp, then we're going to take a vacation, And then in July, you know, they're going to be at this camp. And then we're going to go to Disney World. And what's that all about? What's that all about? There's a real pressure a lot of times as a parent. Are you a parent? I don't know. Right? There is a pressure that if you don't send your kids to camp, I mean, this is camp for our kids this summer. This is it. Well, that's not entirely true. My son is a soccer freak, so he did go to a soccer camp, all right, for 1 week. It was a half day each day. But there's a real pressure that if you don't send your kids to camp, if you're from a relatively affluent Caucasian community, which I am, all right, sorry, I am, right, that if you don't send your kid to camp, you're somehow deficient. All right, they're going to stay at home all day, and we have it even worse because we live in the country in the middle of nowhere. Our nearest neighbor is actually about a mile away, and he's an 85-year-old man. All right, that's it. And then it's 2 miles after that. All right, 3 miles to the next kid. Right, so what are your kids going to do all summer? Sometimes my daughter actually had a friend, Margaret. They were best of friends from about age 2 to about age 8 or 9. And Margaret came over when she was 9, and she has a great family, a decent family life, all right? So she came over for a sleepover, and she got bored at our house. There was nothing to do. Okay, we have hills, we have a creek, we have this big outdoors. She got bored. We don't have cable. At that point, we did not have the internet. We don't have, you know, a home theater system, obviously. We have dogs. We have a cat, we got about 40 fish, but she was bored. And that was a real problem because I didn't know what to do with Margaret, and I had known her almost all her life. So again, that 40% less time with our kids, 39% more time with TV. There's a problem there. All right, let me just get through a couple of other statistics and we're almost done, and then we'll finish up this and get to some questions. I'll be really quick, but these are stunning. The aim of college freshmen, all right, this was a Stanford-based study. It was repeated by, I think it might have been Yale. It was one of the big East Coast schools. Same results. To be well off, aims of college freshmen, all right, to be well off financially, that was the aim of 44% of college freshmen in 1967, all right? The same battery of questions were asked in 2007, and there the aim to be